Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. Subscribe to SubChina's daily access newsletter to keep on top of all the latest news from China from hundreds of different news sources. Or check out all the original writing on the site at SubChina.com, including reported stories, editorials, regular columns, a growing library of videos, and, of course, our podcasts. We cover everything from China's fraught foreign relations to its ingenious entrepreneurs, from the ongoing repression of Uyghurs and other Muslim people in China's Xinjiang region to China's ambitious efforts to eliminate poverty. It's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world, covering China with neither fear nor favor. I'm Kaiser Guo, coming to you today from my home in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. In recent weeks, China released some top-line data from its 2020 decennial census, and probably to the surprise of very few people, it showed that China's population growth continues to slow. A lot. Hoped for gains in fertility from the change in family planning policy back in 2015 that allowed most families to have two children seems to have had very little effect. It has done very little to reverse the trend. Not long afterward, China finally formalized what many had speculated would be next, a further loosening with a push for young people to have more children. This three-child policy, however, seems to have been received in China with a collective Bronx cheer. Not surprisingly, we've seen a lot of commentary again on China's demographic destiny. So with me here today, actually in person for the first time in almost 16 months, very special episode, is Cai Yong, who is associate professor in the Department of Sociology right here at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Dr. Cai is one of the most widely cited specialists in China's social demography, and it's an honor to have him here on the show. Cai Yong, welcome to Seneca and welcome to my house.
It's such an honor and such a, I don't know how to describe it. It's such a revealing experience, just like,
yeah.
Hey, we are here. We are back in social life.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sitting like less than 6 feet from you.
That's
fantastic.
Right. Without masks on.
No masks. It's great. Yeah. Anyway, let's jump right in here. Let's start with the 2020 census. So in late April, before any announcements, the Financial Times published an article with this attention-grabbing headline. It said, China is set to report first population decline in five decades. They ran this story after the official census had been concluded, but before government departments had reached any consensus on the census, on the data, and before they had made these findings public. So you had some issues with the way that the Financial Times handled this report. What do you think that they did and got wrong?
Okay, I think just backtrack a little bit was because the Chinese National Bureau of Statistics did not provide its annual estimate of birth number for 2020 in its 2020 statistical bulletin for the prior year's basic socioeconomic and statistics. Mm-hmm. And usually in that report, they would provide the number of births in the prior year. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, they did not provide for the first time in a long time. So that when the report was released, it was promised that the census number will come out in April. So the Financial Times, in a way, picked on that, say, hey, it's already April. We still don't see the number. What's going on? So all kinds of rumor come out to be frying that speculation was right. The number of births was too low that it could imply for a negative population returns. And they cited that inside my doubt, I'm very much in doubt that they had any real insider to start with.
Right, right. And you have your suspicions as to who that is, but you don't need to tell us.
That's right, yeah.
So, yeah, that's it was not surprisingly they came out with the actual census data later. And, you know, even though the whole set of data has not been released yet, just from the top line numbers that are out now, I mean, things like, you know, only 12 million births, the slowest growth in, I think, what, half a century now.
That's right.
Yeah. Was there anything that's come out so far that was a surprise to you? Or that was noteworthy and maybe hasn't been given sufficient attention in the popular media?
You know, I think one thing is that the birth number itself, 12 million, was very low. And but the interesting thing is they mentioned this number called 1.3 kids per woman in 2020. Right. And that was the first time, actually, the Chinese Bureau of Census cited as most likely. Okay, again, they did not say exactly what was the source, what time frame they were talking about, but they are basically directly citing a census number to quantify the fertility. In the previous census, for example, 2010 census, 2000 census, they often just, you know, let the number pass because they did not believe the number. And this time, seems like they believe in this number. They think this number is reflecting the reality on the ground that the Chinese fertility is truly low. It's not a statistical artifact.
Huh. Okay, that's very interesting. So I think we have more reason to believe that it's well, a reliable number. I mean, the 1.3, that's far below replacement rate.
That's right. So in the previous census, starting from, roughly 1990 census, and the problem get much worse in 2000 census because of the one-child policy. We knew at the time many people did not report their births, did not report their children, whether it's first child or second child, and there were lots of hidden kids in the population, and they were later on revealed by like enrollment number in schools, and that's why we had a very strong suspicion. On one hand, we sort of look at the census as if that's a gold standard for evaluating all kinds of numbers for Chinese population. At the same time, we have had very strong suspicion about those numbers,
right,
particularly for the children and infants side. But same time, seems like this time they have good confidence in this number. They are citing this number and using this number to justify this policy change.
Just so for a reference for people who don't follow demography really closely, what is the replacement rate?
So the ideal replacement is very simple. Basically, for a population to replace itself, a woman on average need to have 2.1 kids, one for herself, one for her partner, and 0.1 to count in the
infant
sex
mortality,
sex ratio at birth, and infant mortality. That's right. Yeah.
Okay. So China's top-heavy demographic pressure, the infamous 4-2-1 structure, puts a lot of pressure on the country's social safety net. It raises very serious concerns about labor shortages, about healthcare costs, about much more. So one of the fixes that is currently sort of on offer, being discussed, is raising the minimum retirement age, as China has some of the world's lowest, 60 years for men. I think it's 55 for women?
That's right, for women.
55 right. For women. Let's talk about fixes like that one, about raising the retirement age, and some of the other policy changes that are being discussed to try to counter this decline, or not decline yet, but this decline in population growth, at least, and the economic impacts that it's likely to bring about. What are some of the things that they're talking about? Let's start with the retirement age.
So retirement age is very interesting. This idea of raising retirement age has been in discussion for quite a while. And at the macro level, everyone agree, this we cannot go on like this for long because, we do a very simple calculation. China's life expectancy is quickly approaching to 80. And basically, on average, people will live about 80 years. And if someone get out of school at 22 and retire at 60, you do the math. You spend more time not working than working. So that would not work. So basically, everyone is talking about, say, hey, we need to do this. But at the same time, if you talk to different people at the individual level, people have very, very different perspective. For younger generation, they say, hey, we want people to retire early so we can take up those senior positions.
Right.
For elderly, they're saying, hey, we have been working for so long that we, you know, want to enjoy our retirement early. We want to get our retirement benefit. So we, you know, don't want the retirement age to be raised. For the, you know, entrepreneurs, for the company, say, hey, senior people are much harder to deal with. Yes, they got experience. They got all kinds of good things. But at the same time, younger people have probably have higher productivity. This, you know, age-based discrimination is right there. So everyone's saying, hey, it's good for the country to do that, but for at an individual level, there are very strong resistance. And you know, China is indeed, you know, basic demographic reality has settled in, and the plan is to raise it all the way to probably at least 65 over the next decade or so.
For both genders?
For both genders. I don't think that the gender-based, you know, for female at 55. You know, right now, actually, some female can ask for earlier retirement at as early as 50.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Wow, I'd be retired already. That'd be awesome if I were a Chinese woman. But what about some of the other things that they're talking about? What, I mean, we can get to this three-child policy and encouragement of births, but what about a policy like immigration? Is that even something that that people discuss?
You know, I don't think immigration has been in the Chinese discussion in any serious way, because partly there are two things. Partly the Chinese population itself so large, you can say, hey, if we want to have a large size of immigrants coming to China, that means, you know, where the sources will be, where the immigrants will be coming from. Second, China is mostly a monolithic cultural, you know, society, and how to deal with immigration is something I don't think the society is ready for that, and I don't think there's enough discussion.
We're talking about, you know, very pervasive racism, right?
That's right.
I mean, we just look at this, a few thousand Africans living in the city of Guangzhou, and how perennial that race issue is, even with that such a small population. It's amazing to see, you know, how stridently people oppose the idea of opening China to as a country of immigration. It's just really pretty shocking to me. But, you know, again, also not shocking at all. And okay, and finally, what about this idea of pushing for increased numbers of births? What's I've described the reaction as not very enthusiastic, but
you know,
the three-child policy.
Yeah, the three-child policy. You know, we saw, you know, I think this is a very big contrast to the, you know, two-child policy when it was announced. You know, I think in general, people were welcoming the policy change. Basically, it gave people the opportunity, the possibility to have a third child, to have a second child at a time. But this round, based on maybe my reading is biased, but based on my reading on social media, on Xinlang Weibo and, you know, Pengyouquan on Weixin, it's almost universally negative. And the government basically ridiculed, you know, being ridiculed by everyone. And I think that the reason was probably quite simple, is that people did not view this as a freedom bestowed on them.
Right.
And it's more a demand. Basically, the government is saying, hey, we want you to have three kids, and the burden is on, you know, a younger generation to deliver. And clearly, that's not going to happen.
The timing of it was terrible. I mean, it was obviously a reaction to the census news, or it seemed that way to a lot of people. I mean, you know, and yeah, I can totally understand why. So, I mean, you recently wrote an op-ed in the New York Times, published, actually, it was just yesterday, we're recording today on June 9th, with your co-author Wang Feng from the UC Irvine, from the University of California in Irvine. You wrote about this three-child policy announcement. And in the piece, you write basically that, you know, the CCP had to expect this kind of a negative reaction from the Chinese public about the announcement. You know, there was a lot of, you know, ridicule, a lot of jokes on social media, even a lot of quite, you know, angry reactions and real frustration. And it led to, you know, I think more discussions of pressing discussions about the costs of rearing a child, about skyrocketing costs of healthcare, of education, especially of sort of extra curricular education, which seems to be so necessary in this hyper-competitive environment now, of housing costs especially. So, you know, given what the party must have known, why do you think, I mean, they knew that it would be unpopular, maybe even bound to fail. Why are they still pursuing it? And why? What was the logic behind that?
You know, I think there are two sides. First, you know, I think by announcing this policy, it's clear an indication that they acknowledge there is a problem, that China is facing this, you know, demographic crisis, and the government need to do something, need to address something. This is, you know, it's a bigger country with fertility at this level. It's not going to be sustainable in longer term. At the same time, they clearly are not willing to give up or even acknowledge the past mistakes.
Right.
Yeah. And they want to be in control. And I think that at the same time, they probably know, even, you know, the alternative would be just to totally give away the control altogether, let people to choose whatever they want to do. But this, that sort of would defeat their purpose as well. They want people to have three kids. That's partly, I think, the negative reaction is based on people say it's a demand. It's not a freedom.
So why then frame it that way if they understood that that might be the reaction? Why not just, you know, if they're so concerned about a population that can't support China's long-term, you know, economic development, why don't they just get rid of all birth restrictions completely and make it a freedom?
No, there are many different, you know, concerns. You know, first, foremost, you know, the Communist Party, the regime is established on population control. I'm sort of using population control in the broadest term, like hukou policy is a form of population control.
Sure.
And right now, for example, if you want to buy a house in anywhere, not anywhere, in most of the cities in China, you need to show all kinds of population related, like your employment status, your, you know, tax contribution. All those forms are part of population control. So they have been relying on this form of control for a long time, and they simply could not give that up. That's first.
So it's sort of macro bureaucratic inertia.
It's not just the bureaucratic. I think it's more
ideological.
Ideological.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, a related point is that this, you know, I think it's related to what's going on in a much more broader sense. The control itself, the political control itself, for example, in Xinjiang, right, for the past few years, they have been relying on the population control, birth control to enforce certain policy.
Right.
Yeah. And they could not simply give up that power.
I see. I mean, so, you know, it's been, as you say, a crucial part. Population control, broadly construed, has been a really important part of state policy for many decades now, really since the inception of the People's Republic. What do you see the party facing in terms of a downside for them continuing to aggressively steer, you know, try to steer this ship through this demographic crisis through essentially political measures?
You know, I think it's sort of, in a way, they set up for their own failure. You know, the ultimate power comes out with ultimate responsibility. So right now, I think, you know, for example, the fertility decline overall, we know with or without one-child policy, with social economic development, people would, you know, want to have fewer kids. And this has been witnessed all across the world. But now any population problem, people tend to, the most obvious answer and the blame is on the Chinese Communist Party. That, you know, because of this, yes, they certainly should, you know, bear the responsibility.
So, but if we go back to the dawn of reform and opening, and if we go back to 78, 79, were the leaders completely wrong to want to pursue, you know, aggressive curbs on population growth? I mean, weren't there some valid reasons to be concerned about population? I mean, in that time frame, I mean, not knowing what we know now, but, you know, the Club of Rome had published this Limits of Growth that painted a kind of, you know, Malthus light kind of picture of how resource constraints were going to really prevent economic growth and it was going to be exacerbated by out of control population growth. At that point, it's not clear to me that anyone would have had the foresight to know that the Earth's carrying capacity was going to be. So Norman Borlaug had developed dwarf wheat, but we didn't know what the impact of the Green Revolution was going to be. You know, we had Yuan Longping develop hybrid rice in China, but we didn't know what the impact of the carrying capacity was going to be. I mean, and I think there weren't any cases that you could have pointed to clearly. We're still in the post-war baby boom, really, toward the end of it. You couldn't have pointed to a country and said, well, see, it's clear that once you reach a certain level of development, population growth falls off as a natural result. So were they completely just out of their minds, or did it make some sort of sense?
Well, no, I think they were not out of their mind. It was a very much a rational choice based on some false understanding and false assumptions. You know, first, for example, the one-child policy came out of some very simple calculation by some planners. Basically, if we want to quadruple our GDP in 20 years, what can we do? So we can. So the calculation was, hey, we can grow our GDP roughly 7% per year, And we need to keep our population in control and do some simple math. Hey, let's keep it within 1.2 billion. But if you go back to the original paper, Song Jian and others' paper, the calculation clearly was not at one child. The one child was a convenient choice at the time. And actually, we can also track a little bit further back into 1977, 78, when the economic planners were doing it, doing the calculation. That's first. Second is the relationship between economic development and population is much more complicated than a simple determinism.
Sure.
And third, I think we, right now, yes, of course, we know that in hindsight, it's much easier to say that, we have enough food, enough air, almost everything for everyone, and China's economic did, fly out on the economic liberalization. So that is true, but, at the same time, going back 40-some years, they knew, even with the one-child policy, the population would still be growing. And even with the one-child policy, that the one-child policy would bring all kinds of negative problems back. And so I think to their credit, we should give them the leaders the credit. They certainly were not a bunch of hypocrites. They enforced the policy from themselves to start with, from their own family to start with. Yes, they certainly deserve certain credit. But at the same time, they had the opportunity to correct this policy along the way, to at least modify, to make it easier, to change the policy according to, for example, by 1990, food supply certainly was no longer a problem anymore.
Right.
They did not have to wait so long. And, the recent change, again, the three-child policy, it's senseless why they keep doing it.
Yeah. I'm curious what you think of this sort of techno-optimist position when it comes to China and its population that, advances in technology, AI, advanced robotics, would make up for the declining workforce, that it would actually help reduce the negative impact of unemployment while actually boosting productivity per employed person, that China was destined in any case to move away from labor-intensive more toward more capital-intensive growth. So, hey, look, we back then in the 70s, we didn't know what the impact of the Green Revolution or the Third Agricultural Revolution was going to be. But we're looking at, we're already the tide of this new Fourth Industrial Revolution is lapping our shores. We're seeing it and it's happening. And shouldn't we have some faith?
I think certainly we should. And I think, sort of referring back to 50 years ago, we did not believe, the pessimists certainly did not believe that we would have enough to eat. The famine would be rampant everywhere, ongoing. And yes, certainly that is true in certain parts of the world. But overall, I think the population crisis or the population bomb has been diffused. So I think we should have some strong faith in the human ingenuity that we can innovate out of this. And demand is probably the best, incentive for innovation. And clearly, people have made all kinds of predictions about Japan demise. Yes, if we compare it to China, that the situation, in terms of economic growth is not that great. But if we look at the life quality, and I think I like to use the life expectancy as the best measure.
Right.
Japan's, my assumption is life must not be bad there.
No, it's not. I'm sure it's not bad at all. I mean, yeah, one hears stories about villages that are utterly depopulated where they're making life-size dolls everywhere to replace the young people that once lived there. But yeah, no, right. Obviously, China is not the only country that's undergoing declining population growth. A lot has been said about Japan, but there's also South Korea, which reported that its population fell for the first time in the country's history recently. European countries like Italy and Greece for a long time. France also, I think, if you take out immigration, it's falling very fast. So governments have been scrambling to come up with policies to reverse these trends. From the Japanese experience, though, what do you think China can learn from this? I mean, besides, I think you hinted at this, and I totally agree. We're not measuring this right. I mean, it's not just a matter of GDP growth. I think that we should have some better sort of quality of life measurements, and by those, I wouldn't mind seeing just less breakneck development in China, that's for sure.
Yeah, I think, you know, what's the purpose of the policy? I think that's probably a bigger question to ask is, you know, how do we measure a country or people's welfare? Is it, you know, yes, population health overall, as I mentioned, life expectancy itself is probably a very good measure, if not the best. At the same time, when we're facing the demographic decline, you know, population decline, what kind of measure should we use? You know, for example, right now there's quite a strong anxiety in terms of, on the national pride, because if we project into the future, China's population will decline at a certain rate, and maybe by the end of this century, the Chinese population will be at 700 million. Is 700 million a small number? That's probably no. Not a small number to start with. And I think, you know, I always tell people we all should celebrate to start with that, you know, finally we put, you know, women finally have a choice to make. They are their own agency. They have the means, they have the freedom to make the choice. And if we want to boost fertility, if we want to change the demographic trajectory, we should, you know, front and center them, hear Absolutely. From them, you know, what they want, Exactly. and what the society, what the government can do.
Right. I mean, it has to put women first. I mean,
that's right. Right.
That's not what's happening. You know, you just afflicted something, and other people have talked about it too. Bert Hoffman at the University of Singapore, he suggested that, you know, China's declining population should actually be welcomed. That it's, you know, that a population, say, let's say, you know, 700 million people, it would be much less of a burden in terms of its environmental impact, its water resources, on, you know, limited agricultural land. What do you buy this idea, right? You imagine that a China half its size by the end of this century would actually be a substantially happier.
No, I you know, the truth is I don't judge, you know, the society in this way. I try as a demographer. I probably trained to be you know, link everything to population, but I sort of resent the idea of the simplistic version of demographic determinism.
Yeah.
That to say, hey, you know, back 50 years ago, China had too many people. Now China had, you know, and down the road, they'll have too few people. I think it's the same, coming back to the, you know, the climate change, the CO2 emission. If we look back for the last 30 some years, the major part, not someone has, you know, calculated this, that over 90% of China's CO2 emission increase was not because of population change. It's because of lifestyle.
Sure, yeah. Sure.
So, you know, human society is much more resilient in many ways. We should not focus on, you know, the size itself. We should care about people.
Yeah, I'm all for saying size doesn't matter as much. Yeah. So, you know, I think it's what you do think matters is the impact on the structure of society, the sociological impact of this. And then you and again with Wang Feng have collaborated on a paper. Has that been published yet?
Or? It's preprint. It's not out yet.
Okay, preprint. Yeah. Looking at the social and sociological consequences of China's one child policy, the distorted gender ratio is, you know, one of the things that gets talked about an awful lot. The age and the age structure and things like that. You spend, you know, a section of your paper discussing new legacies from the one-child policy and how they have essentially reconfigured the whole Chinese family, right? Can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, you know, some scholars are estimating that by 2050, people will not have aunts and uncles, and they won't have, you know.
You know, it's already happening, and one of the numbers revealed by the latest census, 2020 census, the average household size is at 2.6, although we should not equal household size with family size. Household size is a, you know, statistical concept, basically counting who you currently living with.
Right.
And the family is much more, you know, it's a more sociological side. But that does tell us what's going on in Chinese society. In the old image of Chinese family, we have, you know, 3-4 generations living together. Now, more or less, each generation live by themselves, and but the family connection is still very vital. China still, you know, value the family support in many different ways, although sometimes quite instrumental. You know, we save together to send someone to go to college or, you know, coming to United States as a student. So yes, this social tie, you know, any individual's tie to its, you know, the first tie we often, you know, social tie is family itself. This structure itself is drastically changing. People don't have siblings to start with, and now the, because the one-child generation is now the parents' generation, they tend not to have siblings themselves, so they, that means their kids would not have uncles and aunts. But at the same time, I would say, you know, again, society is very much resilient. We often substitute one set of relationship with some different, you know, similar set of relationship, like cousins.
Sure. It was, yeah. For the Bali Ho and the Jolie Ho, it was cousins. And I see how so many of the young people that I know, they talk about their cousins. They don't use 表弟 or 表姐 or 堂弟堂妹 or whatever. They just call them 我姐 or 我弟.
That's right. And it's the social relationship you form, how much you trust, you know, the people next to you. You know, you play together, you grew up together. It's about a shared experience.
But we're talking about, in a few years' time, no cousins even. I mean, when this generation that came up one child and doesn't have siblings, when they have their kids, they're not going to have cousins. Those kids.
That's right. But, you know, the demography is a little bit more nuanced than this. China's, you know, right now have about, you know, by some estimate, 150 million one-child families. But right. That means, you know, actually the majority of Chinese families are not one-child families. So right. They do have cousins. And yes, there's a distorted part because of this 1.5 child policy in the most rural part of China for a long time. If the first child is a girl, people could go on to have a second one. So there's a very much distorted version of the family relationship.
So, but zooming out from that, what are some of the other implications for individuals, particularly for women, of government intervention in family planning programs for so many decades? How are, you know, I mean, we read a lot about, you know, surplus men or missing girls or you know, 剩女, leftover women. Can you talk a little bit about how the public discourse around gender imbalance has changed in Chinese thinking?
So by some estimate, you know, a big number is there are right now about 30 million extra men, you know, spread out about 30, 40 years, you know, because of this mostly because of sex selective abortion.
Right.
And that means, you know, by simple math, that this group of people, you know, if we try to marry off, you know, every man with every woman, we will be left with roughly about 30 million. But the problem is more structural than the number itself. You know, there are a couple of things ongoing. First, that Chinese marriage is still sort of so-called hypergamy pattern. Basically, right. Women tend to marry someone
up,
you know, a older, senior, have better socioeconomic status, you know, higher education. And because of the population size is shrinking, that means there will be fewer women in 2 or 3 years younger than the current generation of men. So that put a huge structural pressure on the male side. The second part is also mostly socioeconomical. Hypergamy itself has very strong socioeconomic tone. You need to have an apartment. You know, you have the Cai Li.
Bride price.
Yeah, that's right. So, and that means the so-called surplus men are more likely to be concentrated in certain social class and certain geographic area.
Right.
And, you know, if you visit like Geming Laoqu, they are villages. You know, you go in, there are, you know, lots of men sitting around and without family.
Yeah. So in other mammalian species, that is not a good thing. Usually they tend to be dangerous.
That's right. You know, but you know, there are articles and books being written linking this problem to you know, like international relationship. Someone actually feared, say, hey, this could cause an international war because China has so many surplus men. I don't buy that argument.
Right, of course.
Or linking to the crime rate. But we know crime is, yes, there's a certain element of that, but the link is quite weak.
Okay, good. I'm glad to hear that. That's a tenuous link. But, you know, maybe they should start thinking about changing laws around sex work or thinking about...
You know, that's on the ground. It's already happening. Sex, you know, that's a huge industry.
Sure.
It's a great industry. And, you know, sex industry indeed release lots of negative energy and also at the same time creates quite a bit of negative energy in the society.
You've written about how, you know, the one-child policy itself drove gender inequality from both, you know, the top and the, you know, top down and from bottom up. But the policy's abolition was also conceived, I think, as a gendered process. And I think you argue that as well. Help us unpack this seeming contradiction here. You know, imposing this was obviously gendered, but also lifting it seems to have been too, maybe placing an undue burden on women.
Yeah, so right now, for example, the reaction to the three-child policy is clearly that people see this as a demand. And especially, I think, from women's perspective, they are now in, you know, the current generation of women is very different.
Oh, yeah.
They grew up, you know, with, you know, the, as many of them as the single child, they be treated more or less equally. That's sort of an, you know, good, positive, unexpected effect of the one-child policy. And they have better education right now if, you know, there are more females in college than males in college.
Right.
And they want their own career. They want their own independence. And they are delaying their childbearing, delaying their marriage for the sake of all kinds of choices they are making. But now, if we think about this three-child policy, the demand is squarely on them. And
that's
we have
right.
all kinds of terms, very negative, you know, terms putting on them. For example, 剩女 itself,
yes. mm-hmm.
it's right on them in sort of everyone's... you know, there's also rumor right now ongoing saying, hey, China may come out with certain policy that make, you know, abortion much, much more difficult. Maybe taking away
really?
Certain concept. You know.
Oh, yeah, God.
There might be just rumors on internet, you know, but it's not out of imagination. It you know, the same logic applies. You know, the logic of China's population control, the one-child policy, all three-child policy is a top-down process. The government dictate when and how many and who should have kids.
Right. You know, Handmaid's Tale is in America, but I mean, it could happen in China too.
That's right. So I think it's, you know, there are already stories. I heard about stories that in Shanghai, for example, in the old days, if someone walk into clinic, you know, being pregnant and by herself, the default question would be, you know, hey, do you want to keep the child or not? But nowadays, the doctors were giving instructions, try to persuade not to have the woman not to have the abortion.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. It's already happening.
That's not just anecdotal. This is actually something that you've documented?
No, I heard about it. Someone wrote this down and circulated on the internet.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, I know, but I think it would be really interesting to look into.
There's no statistics yet.
Right, right.
Yeah, but you know, I think we probably can find doctors to talk about this because clearly they got, you know, instructions from the top.
No, I've certainly had this thought before, and I think that I've witnessed it anecdotally just how, you know, as you said, one of the few kind of surprisingly beneficial impacts of the one-child policy system was this kind of rise in the stature of women. I mean, I figure that they've got, it's sort of a seller's market when it comes to women now. They can be a lot more picky. I think we'd probably statistically be able to document that hypergamy that you were talking about has increased, that sort of the status jumping is reaching even higher, that women can have, you know, sort of more choices in suitors and more agency in determining, you know, their life choices. That's, I think, positive impact of that is also one of the reasons why there's resistance to this third child announcement. And, you know, that seems just so tone deaf and so, you know, something of a long ago patriarchy. It reminds me of Lee Kuan Yew in the 90s, or I guess when in Singapore started to worry about it, and they were kind of, you know, instituting eugenics and urging people to get married. And it was...
Yeah, that's, you know, there were discussions about the policy pair childbearing to education. If you have two kids, you automatically get into an elite school.
Wow.
Something like that, you know. But clearly, the experience in Singapore, you know, did not pan out well. You know, clearly, you know, in modern society, you no longer can basically put women as, you know, childbearing slaves.
So just the paper that you wrote, which is really interesting, you offer a new way of thinking for, I think, academics and scientists to consider demographic studies. And you alluded to this before. You know, you don't like to see people just treated as mere statistics or mere numbers, you know, especially when it comes to things like these social engineering projects, like the one-child policy. You write, I'm going to quote here, by treating people as only numbers and by relying on simplistic numerical exercises to inform policymaking and evaluation, demographic research has left the society out of population studies. I think it's a great idea, and I'll give you a chance to unpack that a little more before we wrap up. You know, tell us about what the alternative path that you offer is. What does a more socially inclusive approach to population studies look like?
You know, I think, you know, this was partly was a reaction to the government's approach that in the late 2000-ish, 2008, 2009, and government keep, you know, boosting, say, hey, this was working. The one-child policy was necessary to be there, and it was working very well. It was part of one main reason behind China's economic miracle, you know, talking about demographic dividend. And they keep using the number of that the one-child policy reduced China's population by 400 million. And that number is so widely cited, even, you know, like the reputable journals like Economist and some, you know, other, you know, Chinese government also use that as an argument to in the Copenhagen meeting, say, hey, we have done our part.
Right.
This is our, you know, contribution to the world's fight against climate change. And yeah, we have done our part. And someone actually wrote an op-ed in the a Canadian newspaper, but the title was the entire world should adopt the China's one-child policy. So, so the idea was basically say, hey, it's all about number. And I think the same thinking is still there when we talk about, you know, we just, you know, talking about this, that China's population will dwindle down to 700 million, and that is linked to national glory. So the question we ask is, where is the people? We have, you know, the reason the society functions, we want to live this world, is that we are all people. We care about each and everyone's well-being and freedom. And so that's where the center should be. And that's, you know, I think, look back, the reason China's one-child policy failed was it did not treat people with dignity, with respect. And why China's economic reform succeeded was it gave the agency, gave the freedom to its people. Hey, we know, we trust you, you can make good choice. Yeah. Yeah.
I get it. That's fantastic. You know, I wonder always though, you know, we think about population decline once we've achieved a level of development, but the argument that I hear sometimes from people who will still defend the one-child policy is that China wouldn't have achieved its economic development had it not curbed population growth. That it would have proved such a hindrance to development that we wouldn't have seen the rates of growth that we saw in the 90s and the 2000s. Is there anything to that? Do you think that...
So I think there are two things. There are certainly some truth to that. You know, if China's population was growing so rapidly, if it's already at, let's say, 1.6 billion or even more, that would be probably a different story. And, you know, given that, indeed, you know, I think the Rome Club, and they have a varied argument. Yes, we only have one Earth to start with, and there's this physical limit of space. But the other side of argument, I think there are a couple of things we need to unpack, is that the China's population, you know, fertility decline did not start from one-child policy. China's fertility decline actually one decade before the one-child policy. That's first.
Ah, wow.
Yeah, so China's fertility was roughly 5.8 kids per woman.
Oh, my God.
In the 1970.
Right.
And in less than one decade, China's fertility was already at 2.8.
Wow.
That's right. And the magic behind success, there are a couple of things. Yes, there's, you know, same tactic were used, you know, as they were used in the enforcement of one-child policy, basically. You know, the slogan at the time was, later, longer, and fewer. Basically, push people to marry at a later time, having longer birth interval, and having at most three kids. But the most important, I think, you know, I see this is true for most of developing countries. There's a hidden demand. It's not at the time women or, you know, peasants want to have as many kids as possible. That was the ideal. But people were very rational. People want, you know, control their fertility in certain way. And the government at the time provided the means to control their fertility. So there are two sides. One is a push, one is a pull, that people want to control their fertility. And the government at same time pushed all kinds of measures to them. That worked like a miracle. That, you know, in less than one decade, fertility cut, you know, more than 50%.
Yeah, I did not know that. I hadn't known that it had dropped so radically just in the course of the decade.
That's right. And the truth is, the other truth is that within the first decade of the one-child policy, Chinese fertility did not drop. It only swung around about 2.5. Basically, the government, you know, policy, the enforcement come in waves. That right. Sometimes they tied up a policy, but the resistance was so strong, they have to, you know, retreat. And then they tied again. So for the entire 1980s, that fertility was, you know, swing around 2.5 kids.
So it's always been more tightly enforced, though, in the urban areas.
And that's right.
In especially the higher tier cities. What is the impact of that? The fact that fertility rates have remained much higher in the countryside, whereas they almost immediately fell, beginning right after 1981, in the cities. What's the impact, the sociological impact of that?
So, and I think that this is tied back to the old Chinese system, the socialist system, the country that was not just one China. There were two, you know, segments of Chinese society. One is the urban part, one is the rural part. Urban part was protected. The reason the fertility could, you know, drop it so quickly was because the government had a much better control of that part of population, and in exchange for the, you know, provision of all kinds of social benefit. And for the countryside, because the government did not have, you know, to provide them, or could not afford to provide them all kinds of benefit, they had to open, you know, losing the policy. So that means, you know, this sort of setting the motion of this later down urbanization, that we say the cheap labor keep coming from rural area.
Right, but that's self-serving too. I mean, because they understood that was a big tailwind to China's export-led growth, right?
I mean, no, I don't think that even Zhao Ziyang, you know, envisioned the export-oriented development, did not envision China could develop so quickly. And remember, the discussion in the early 1990s was like, we're afraid of rural to urban migration.
Right.
They try to regulate and, you know, try to tamp it down.
But by you know, the late 1990s, it was seen as an absolute blessing, though. They understood that was what was driving the engine.
That's right. But, you know, there's a very strong policy contradiction. If you see that's the country's future, you should provide them the basic protection. For example, give them access to education.
Education, right.
No, that's not happening. Right. They still sort of manage China in sort of a very much a two-tiered system.
Well, Taiyong, it's what a wonderful treat to have our first in-person interview to you know, be able to do this. It was so long. It was 2 years ago that we sat down and had lunch in that Sichuan restaurant here.
That's right.
In town. Yeah, I can't believe how fast time goes. Lots more to talk about the next time that we have you on the show. Meanwhile, let us move on to recommendations. Before we do that, I do want to remind listeners that the Seneca podcast is powered by SubChina. And if you like what we're doing with Seneca, with China Stories, with the China in Africa podcast, with New Voices, with Strangers in China, and all the other shows in the network, the best way to show your appreciation, because, you know, these things do cost money after all, is to become a subscriber to SubChina Access. Not only do you get our daily newsletter, but you also get discounted admission to events. Yes, events. And we are going to be having those again before too long, so watch this space, including free admission to live podcasts, which we will also be bringing back. And also the secret RSS feed to be able to listen to Seneca on Monday afternoons U.S. time rather than waiting until Thursday like the rest of the chumps. So sign in, show your support for what we're doing. Let's go on to recommendations. Taiyong, what do you have for us?
I have a recommendation for a not so new book, but it's not old as well. The reason I pick up this book, it's a book by NPR reporter, his name is Scott Tang, and
yeah.
The book is A Village with My Name. The
yeah.
reason I picked up this book was, you know, I knew it was there, but the reason, because of the one-child policy, and he had a serial podcasting and reporting on the one-child policy. So I said, oh, it's time for me to read this book. And it's refreshing in many ways, not just the one-child policy. Now I see the world is sort of, again, divided again. His family history is so interesting. Basically, at the time of transition or change, his ancestors, his great-grandpa, you know, went out of country and they scattered around the world. And now I see the world sort of, again, being divided again. I sort of anticipate maybe, you know, 30 years from now, my son might ask me the same question. Hey, can you bring back to our old village? What's the world is sort of twisting in a very strange way.
That book is great. I interviewed Scott about that book for Seneca. You know, Scott is a longtime radio reporter, so he's got a terrific voice and he's really fun to talk to. He speaks very well. The book, I mean, what's interesting is, you know, the collaborationists in his past, the sort of embarrassing, you know, Japanese collaborationist past. Actually, he had one Japanese ancestor.
That's right.
Really, really fascinating. He's on the other side of his family, not the collaborationist side. It's a fascinating book, and Scott's just a terrific guy. So hopefully he's still listening to the show. So, hey, Scott, get in touch, man. Miss you. Great recommendation, though. I love that book. I haven't revisited it in a while, but I'm going to recommend two things. One is a television show. It's called The Kominsky Method, starring Michael Douglas. It's on Netflix. The first two seasons also stars Alan Arkin, and also Kathleen Turner is on quite a few of them. And you'll remember back in the 1980s, Michael Douglas and Kathleen Turner starred in some movies together, Romancing the Stone and some other stuff. But so I was skeptical at first, but it turns out to be actually just like the right amount of earnest. It's not just, you know, cringy and embarrassing. It kind of takes place in a similar universe, a milieu to Curb Your Enthusiasm, you know, old Jewish guy in Hollywood, you know, Hollywood agents and acting coaches. And it's got, you know, elements of Barry in it, too, which is another great show on HBO. The Kominsky Method, though, it lets you kind of root for the protagonist without embarrassment. And it's not going to, you know, make you just sort of uncomfortable the way that some of these other comedies do. But it's got a gooey middle, and that's something I love about it. The book is a novel that my daughter recommended to me called All the Light We Cannot See by a writer named Anthony Doerr, D-O-E-R-R. It was actually awarded the Pulitzer Prize in 2015. It centers on the lives of two young people in the Second World War. And it's very, very good so far, very moving. My daughter was just dissolving in puddles of tears after finishing it, and so I knew it was probably something I should read. So check it out. It's called All the Light We Cannot See. The girl in it is blind, and her father is part of that sort of pantheon of great literary fathers who is just the most adorable man I've ever come across in literature. So if he suffers a tragic fate in this, I'm going to lose it. Anyway, yeah, so my two recommendations. Thank you so much, Sayo.
Sure, my pleasure.
Yeah, what a pleasure to talk to you, and looking forward to having you back on the show. The Seneca Podcast is powered by SubChina and is a proud part of the Seneca Network. Our show is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldcorn, with editing help by Jason McRonald. Drop us an email at seneca@subchina.com, follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SubChina News, and make sure to check out all the shows in the Seneca Network. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care.